It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Man, it is crazy. I'm excited to be here. It's been a fantastic week here in America. And, you know, we just got through celebrating July 4th. So what does that mean? Well, we wax very patriotically, and we also have a short work week. Most of us are only working 4 days this week. And some of us aren't working at all any more than we did the week before. Ba-dum-bum-tsh. All right. That's just a little attempt to humor there. Great show lined up for you today. We have James Galbraith on the show and Mark Skanuska. I just killed his name, but anyway, nothing he can do about it because he's not here right now. He'll have to correct me later. Anyway, just excited to have you here. And as always, you, our loyal listeners, are the ones who make the show happen. You're the reason that we got syndicated on iHeartRadio. We're also one of the top-rated shows here on Blog Talk. And so we appreciate your support. You know, we're starting to do more on YouTube, so you can check us out on YouTube. Just go directly to YouTube/ Bert Martinez, or Bert J. Martinez, actually. And catch us there. Facebook, always good to hear you guys chatting on our Facebook page and as well as Twitter, so we're thankful for that. We get a lot of our guest ideas, show suggestions, topic suggestions from you, our local listeners. So let's get this party started right away, you know, and I'm excited for my first guest, James Galbraith. James Galbraith is professor at LBJ School of Public Affairs, the University of Texas at Austin, and author of Welcome to Poisoned Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. James Galbraith, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you very much.
All right, so let's talk about this real quick, because obviously I think it's interesting that the title of your book, Welcome to the Poisoned Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. When did you write this?
I wrote it over a five-year period from 2010, but especially in the first half of 2015 when I was working very closely with the finance ministry in Greece. And then I pulled it together last summer, and it came out in the U.S. in June, and it's just appeared in Greece, apparently causing a great deal of ruckus, I'm told, over the email this morning.
Oh, God. Well, you know what? And it's one of those things where, you know, you write a book like this, and then all of a sudden this thing with Beatrix happens. How do you say this without being sounding offensive? But, you know, you almost couldn't ask for it. You know, you couldn't ask for better events, because it really, kind of shows you that the future of Europe is in question.
No question about that. And the British referendum vote just upset all kinds of apple carts. And people were – I was in England, actually, when it happened, and got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to see what the vote was. And you could just see both the shock on the faces of the news readers for the BBC giving these results, and then a little bit later when the Leave campaigners came on board to be commenting, it was clear that they didn't have the vaguest idea what they were going to do next, that they too expected it not to happen. But it does tell you that the whole European project is just much more fragile than its own leadership thought it was.
Sure. So let's talk about this. What were you watching? What were you seeing? Or what was the inspiration to have you create this book or write this book, The Welcome to the Poisoned Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe?
Well, I became involved in Greek matters early in the Greek crisis, which really broke out in 2010. I was a friend of the Prime Minister at the time, George Papandreou, went to provide some moral support. And in the next few years, I got to know an economics professor at the University of Athens, Yanis Varoufakis, who became quite a close friend. He came to Texas for a few years to teach, and then suddenly he became finance minister. So there I was. I got a message from Yanis the day he took office saying, get here as soon as you can. And I was plunged into the negotiating process between this new Greek government and its European creditors in a very, very difficult, intense 5-month process, which ultimately led a year ago today to the referendum that the Greek government called on the negotiating terms. The Greek people stood up and rejected those terms, but the government capitulated anyway, and that brought an end to my, to my involvement. Yanis Varoufakis resigned the next day, and I left Greece.
Okay, so why don't you so catch us up? What has happened in Greece? Because you hear sound bites, and because Greece is this this land far away, and it doesn't necessarily affect me and my family. People aren't really paying that close attention. So tell us, what is happening in Greece? Catch us up, and what does it mean to us?
Well, Greece has been in a depression for now 5-6 years. It's lost about a third of its income. The unemployment rate's about 30%. For youth, it's about 60%. Professionals are basically being forced to emigrate. And this is the depth and severity of this has to do with the fact that Greece got into a lot of debt in the run-up, in the first years of the euro, the first decade after the euro came into effect. When the world crisis hit and Greece couldn't pay those debts, it was put through a ringer of an economic policy, which has basically crushed private enterprise in Greece. So it's a sign of a country being treated, I think, very badly by its creditors with an economic policy that's basically the policy of a debt collection agency, without the consideration that you need to have for the revival of the economy, the well-being of the people. What does it mean for us? Well, it's similar to the situation faced by the city of Detroit or by the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. These are conditions that come up, and how they're handled in a relationship between legitimate creditor interests and the even more legitimate interests of economic recovery and the survival and prosperity of the country is of just crucial importance.
Absolutely. All right, so how do you think it's possible to fix this? I mean, this is obviously the end of Greece as we know it, and so what are your thoughts? How does Greece fix this? Is it just going to have to do, baby steps for the next decade?
Well, it's in a very tough – right now what's going on is basically a liquidation. It's a fire sale. It's basically the Greek state is selling off everything that brings in money, including ports and airports and mass transit systems. Well, you name it, anything that has monetary value, and beaches too. Greece is a country – where practically the only one, I think, in Mediterranean Europe where the beaches are all public and public assets. And this is one of the things that has given Greece its charm and its beauty. And those are also now on the auction block to private interests. So you're going to get a complete change in the over time in the quality of the country. Private businesses are being forced into bankruptcy, and private homeowners are being forced into foreclosure. So it's very much like what happened in large parts of the U.S. following the financial crisis. What can be done about this? Essentially, there has to be a change of policy in Europe, or the matter will be forced eventually by various forms of resistance. It is really crunch time on these questions in Greece and in Southern Europe generally at the moment.
So, assuming that I have the money, you're telling me that I can go, I can go to Greece and buy one of their public beaches or possibly an airport or any other landmarks?
Well, the airports have already been sold to the Germans. But yeah, there are beaches and there are other landmarks that you could probably get. I think this will not be very successful because obviously the population isn't happy about this. There's a fundamental sense of the injustice of forcing the country into this kind of transformation because of loans that were made to corrupt politicians, corrupt businesses, 10-15 years ago to buy submarines, jet aircraft, or for big construction projects that benefited primarily the construction companies, which were not Greek but German or other North European companies. So there is just a deep sense of an unresolved injustice here, and rightly so. That is the essence of the issue in Greece.
Yes. You know what? And also, I agree with what you said. Is this going to fail? Most likely. Look, because sooner or later, Greece is going to come out of this. And let's say a new administration takes over. You know, I could certainly see a new administration maybe reneging or at least kicking Germany out. Hey, thanks for helping us out. We're back on our feet. Here's some money. You're no longer on the airports.
Nationalizations or let's say privatizations are not necessarily permanent. That's true. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon because the Greek political situation for the moment is entirely blocked. I think it's obvious that the formulas that are being imposed on Greece now will not be accepted indefinitely by the Greek population.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. This is just such an extraordinary thing. It's one of those situations, James, that you know people think that a municipality's got money or a community has money or a state or a nation has money, but this goes to show you that anything can happen. I mean, anything can happen. And the reality is that in some cases, you know, there are several municipalities here in our nation that are on the verge of being like Greece.
Well, municipalities in the U.S. have an advantage, which is that they can go into bankruptcy and protect the core public services and get reorganized and protect pensions. So the creditors don't have the overriding power. But what's happened in mm-hmm. Greece is that the creditors say, you can't go bankrupt, we're not going to restructure your debt, and you have to figure out ways to satisfy us. And that's a situation, as I say. Normally, in creditor-debtor relationship, there's some safety valve which permits an unpayable debt to be restructured. But that is what has been happening here.
And what I don't understand, and maybe you can shed some light on this. So if I'm Greece and you have a creditor is bugging the crud out of me and saying, hey, I want my money, Bert. You owe me this money. You've owed me this money for a long time. Give me this money. No, you're going to have to wait till we restructure. I just don't understand why Greece didn't just say, no, we're going to wait. We're going to restructure. Whether or not you like it, you know, you can't get money from us if we disappear. And it just seems like Greece in a kind of reverse way has the power to just say no. Or am I missing something?
Well, you would think, but the creditors have another piece of leverage, which they used on the Greek government in last year, and that is they can close the banking system. So if you have a deposit in a Greek bank, and you're looking at the possibility it could be reduced to pennies on the euro. And that would then really frozen up the Greek economy. And it was that threat which came through the European Central Bank, which was, I think, the most important single thing in causing the Greek government to fold its tent a year ago and say, no, well, okay, just tell us what to do, which they've been doing for the last years, saying, oh, give us your instructions and we'll cram them through the Greek parliament. That's a powerful threat. Obviously,
sure,
the Greek population has reacted to it by keeping their bank deposits down to an absolute minimum, which is very sensible on their part. But it does mean that the economy can't reset and find any traction because there's no bank loans and there's no people are say minimizing their banking activity.
So what we see happening in Greece is the opposite of what happened here in the U.S., where the banks were in trouble and they looked to the U.S. government to bail them out. In this case, you had really the banks that had all the power and really didn't want to bail out the government.
The banks were vulnerable to the actions of the European Central Bank, and the issue here is that the central bank in the United States is our Federal Reserve. It's under the authority of the Congress. It has a mandate to support the whole economy. It does try to do that. The European Central Bank is a different institution with a lot more autonomous power. Greece is only a very small part of the European economy. And so basically what they said to the Greeks was, you fall in line or we will yank the deposits out of your banking system and you will be absolutely flat on your backs. I think it would be very hard for the Federal Reserve to get away with, and even if had the inclination, with a similar threat in the United States.
So what is your best guess? What do you think is going to happen with Greece? What should we expect in the future?
Depression, despondency, and immigration, I think, are the main things that will happen for the immediate future, because you can't do business there. And it's not attractive for foreign investment because the schools have been run down, the health service has been run down. There will be continuing to have the tourist trade. Basic asset isn't going to go away. But the capacity for any real recovery seems to be blocked for the indefinite future. And until such time as there's either a change of policy in Europe or a change of a really new and renewed tough Greek government, for which there's at the moment no foundation has been laid.
Right. And so let's talk about the tourist trade real quick. Like you said, that's going to stay there. And obviously, if you have a dollar, I'm assuming that the dollar is pretty strong against the is it the euro that they still use?
Yeah, no, the Greeks are still in the euro. So yes, the dollar is up somewhat against the euro, for sure. Not so much. I mean, the British pound is way down, though, so Greece has become more expensive for English travelers, and they're a major source of the tourist trade in Greece. That's not good news.
James Galbraith, thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Nice to talk.
Important to have you back again. All right. Good stuff there, or interesting stuff there from James Galbraith, professor at LBJ School of Public Affairs. The book, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Timely book there that he worked on for over 5 years, I think he said. Anyway, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. You know, my next guest, Mark Snukas, was kind enough to send me an audio of how to pronounce his last name. It's spelled S-N-I-U-K-A-S, pronounced Snukas. So we appreciate that, Mark. And let me tell you a little bit about Mark. Mark is a strategic innovation expert and the author of the best-selling book, The Art of Opportunity. Just love that title, The Art of Opportunity. And we're going to be talking about the three types of growth businesses should consider. And this is, I think, one of those books that everybody should have in their library. He's also a co-founder of the Business Model Gallery, the world's largest business model database. Mark and his colleagues work with organizations to discover and seize opportunities for new growth through strategic innovation and business design. You can visit Mark and his team at finukas.com to learn more about Mark and theartofopportunity.net, and you can download a free preview there. Mark Snukas, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hi, Bud. Thanks for having me on your show today.
You bet. You bet. All right. So talk about The Art of the Opportunity, the name of the book, The Art of Opportunity. And so how did that book come into being? I mean, was there some research that kind of led you down this road? Talk about this.
Yes, exactly. So a while ago, I asked myself, how do established companies in traditional industries design, implement new and possibly innovative business models? And by established companies, I meant not looking at startups and how they do it, because we all know that startups can be pretty innovative. So I was more looking into the incumbents. And I was looking in traditional industries, so everything outside of online businesses and of e-business. And I was actually pretty serious about answering that question. So I went to Manchester Business School in the UK, and I got a PhD on answering it. And then that research turned into the book, The Art of Opportunity, in which we outline how established companies can actually find opportunities for new growth and how they can seize these opportunities by creating completely new businesses and new ventures with innovative offerings, innovative business models.
Yes, you know, it's it's a shame that your book did not reach the management people there of Kodak or of Blockbuster Entertainment, because those companies at one point were the leaders of their industry, and because they missed the art of opportunity, they're gone.
Yeah, right. Right, yeah, so I guess the book wasn't out then.
All right, so let's talk about this. What to do if your traditional way of selling marketing don't work anymore? What do you do?
Well, so usually if you want to grow, for example, it doesn't work as well as it used to be, companies have a tendency to look at their existing customers. And usually they look at the best known or the most satisfied customers, and they mm-hmm. want to improve the customer experience and the whole offering even more for them. So I get to travel quite a lot, and I'm in the top tiers of frequent flyer programs, and they keep on asking me every quarter about what they could do even better. But I mean, I give them already so much business, there isn't room to grow from my side at least. So in order to grow your business and to relaunch new businesses, let's say, you should focus on what we call non-customers. So you should look into not your best customers, but rather your least satisfied customers, maybe your least profitable customers, and into customers that are not interested in buying from you, and ask yourself, well, what is it that keeps these customers from doing business with us, and how can we unlock that that potential and the opportunities that are hidden with these customers? And
yes,
you do so by
yes.
so.
Yeah, and I want to stop there a second. So again, what a lot of businesses do is they'll go to their most satisfied customers, try to find out what's making them happy, and try to sell them more. You're saying, hey, that's fine, but some of these people are going to be at capacity. What you need to do is get more customers.
Yeah, sure. I think if you're looking to grow your business exponentially, you're not going to find that growth with your existing customers. So you need to find a way to turn non-customers into your customers. Let me give you maybe an example. One of the case studies that I looked into is Pro7, which is the leading German TV media company. And as a TV media company, it generates revenues by selling advertising minutes on TV. Now, in 2012, they set themselves the target to grow by 1 billion, which was basically going from 2.4 billion to 3.4 billion until the end of 2018. Now, that might sound like a big number, but if you actually break it down into the five-year period, it's only a 10% year-on-year growth. But still, it is a big number. Now, the challenge they face is obviously that the German TV market is pretty saturated. You've got two big players. And actually, by law, there is a limit on how many advertising minutes on average you can do in a day. So there is no more room to grow here. So where does the 1 billion come from? Now, ProSieben asked itself, okay, well, who doesn't buy? And typically, so the typical TV media companies, the customers are the Procter & Gamble's, Coca-Cola, Unilever, so the big names who buy quite a lot of volume. And because they also buy quite a lot of volume, they also have some negotiating power, and usually they get heavy discounts on the usual list price. Now, companies that don't buy are startups and small and medium companies. Why don't they buy? Well, they can either not afford it, they don't have the cash, or maybe they can afford it, they would have the cash, but they don't want to spend the cash on something risky like doing TV advertising, because you're never sure of the return that you're going to get. And even if they are prepared to take the risk, they don't have any experience with doing TV advertising. So ProSieben looked at these non-customers and said, okay, what can we offer them? How can we turn them into customers? So they came up with something they called Media for Revenue. So they said, we're going to give you the advertising for free, but we're going to get a share of the revenues that we generate from the advertising that we do. Now, they started doing this. They did this for quite some time with a couple of customers. They evolved the model. So nowadays it is Media for Revenue Share, but it's also Media for Equity. And at the end of the day, the business or the strategy worked so well that they turned it into a dedicated business. And meanwhile, that business makes one third of their revenues. So it went from zero to 1 billion in a matter of 5 years. And they actually last year, they already achieved the growth target of 1 billion through that new business. And they increased their revenue targets for 2018 to 1.85 billion. So all new growth coming from a customer that was not served at all before.
You know, and again, I'm going to use Blockbuster because I think that Blockbuster is a perfect example of this. You know, they were losing market share. And at one point, they did try to create – let me back up. They had met with Netflix and basically told Netflix no. 5 years later, they're trying to institute a Netflix type of system, and then all this infighting begins with inside the company, and you know that program after only a year or so gets shut down, and the CEO gets fired, and just a few years after that, Blockbuster goes bankrupt. And I think the lesson here is that Blockbuster failed to go after their new customers and to really identify what their customers wanted.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what they did or how they really reacted, but I could assume that they just tried on making their existing business better, kind of serving existing customers better, doing maybe faster shipping, decreasing the prices, all the things that you would usually expect. Meanwhile, customers were turning to Netflix, and I guess that this is a very nice example where a strategy should make, or the value proposition of your strategy for the customer should all be about making the customer's life easier, right? And Netflix just achieved to do that very well compared to Blockbuster.
Yes. No. Absolutely. I think that there's a lesson here that correlates directly with what you're talking about, and the book is The Art of Opportunity, because really there is an art to that, and we see people all the time that miss opportunity, and of course it's what is it, the old saying, hindsight is 20/20. So let's talk about this a little bit. When you talk about the three types of growth, evolutionary, adjacent, and breakthrough, give me some examples.
Yeah, well, let's maybe use again ProSieben. So evolutionary growth might have meant better advertising, more interesting shows, so more people watch. And this is also something they do, and this might be something that that Blockbuster had focused on, for example. And then we have the second type, which is adjacent growth. So compared to the first one, where you really focus on your existing offering, with adjacent growth, you try already to go for new opportunities for generating revenue. So in the case of Pro7, again, how can we do more advertising? How can we do maybe different types of advertising? Instead of only doing advertising on TV, we might do something which is very similar. So creating online platforms and sell some advertising space there. And then comes the third category, which is then really breakthrough growth, where which then comes from inventing a completely new business. In the case of Pro7, with a new revenue model, which opened up TV advertising to, as I said, a customer market that had never been even considered an interesting market for TV advertising. Or another good example, which I always like, is Amazon. So if you think about it, evolutionary growth for Amazon was adding more books, making it easier to buy books online. Adjacent growth was then adding other products next to books. So first it was CDs, then it was DVDs, and these days I think you can buy pretty much everything on Amazon. And now comes breakthrough growth, where they ventured into completely new areas and different areas. So for Amazon, that meant, for example, offering web services. They offer payment services, developing the Kindle or Amazon TV, which has nothing really to do anymore with selling books online now, has it?
No. And you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head with Amazon. I think they're a great example of a couple of different things. So if anybody remembers this, Amazon originally was a book store, right? A book reseller. They wanted to be the biggest bookstore in the world, right? And now they want, and then later on they wanted to be the biggest store in the world. And now I think their tagline is to be the most customer-centric company in the world. Excuse me. And so what we see here is that they are going through this evolutionary process. And now not only can you buy just about everything in the world in Amazon, but you can also have it delivered the same day, the next day, depending on your situation, and they're looking for ways
to
deliver it within a few hours.
Yeah, or even instantly in the case of Kindle, right? So you get your book just a second later.
Yes, that's right. That's a great example. And so, it's just a wonderful thing. But I think that's a great example of that evolutionary process, because these guys are always looking for what's next and how they can deliver more value. In fact, another thing is that if you have to return something to Amazon, is they either give you instant credit, or if it's a product that's defective, for instance, they will send you a new product, Then once you get the new product, then you ship back the defective product. So they're putting your needs ahead of theirs. The old model is, if you have a bad product, you got to ship it back to the company, and then once they get it, they'll ship you a new product. Amazon is changing the way that it's done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you mentioned earlier. So they try to be really customer focused and offering a great experience to the customer, and it's all about making life more convenient and doing business with Amazon easier for the customer.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so when let's look at, okay, so we have that example. What are the other examples that you might have for like breakthrough or adjacent?
Something I also quite interesting, a case study that I like a lot, is a Swiss private hospital. And they also ask themselves, well, who is really our customer, and how do actually customers come to our clinic? Why do they pick our clinic? And so they did some market research, they did some primary research, they did some secondary research, but they also really, they spoke to the customers, they spoke to all the different stakeholders they have, and they gained two very, 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 very important insights. The first one is that it's actually not the patient who picks the hospital, but it's usually a doctor, a family doctor, who refers the customer to the hospital, or it's a specialist surgeon who says, I want to just operate you here in this particular clinic. So they turned from being a B2C company, if you like, so focusing on the patient, into a B2B company, focusing more on the doctors and offering the doctors a great experience and all the services that they need to do their job well, so that they would pick Hills London as their primary hospital where they want to work. And the second insight they gained was that for the patient, so assuming the medical treatment works sufficiently well, for their well-being and for their satisfaction, what is much more important are all the services around the operation, what they came to call the non-medical services. So all the food, for example, all the services that you get in when you're in bed, in your room, all of these things, which led them to introduce a service like in a five-star hotel. So they actually hired a former hotel manager to run what they call now the non-medical services. They hired staff from five-star hospitals to really be able to provide a excellent service to the patients. And as I said, they also focus on...
I just want to clarify, because you said they hired staff from a five-star hotel as well?
Yes, yeah. So they have staff, doesn't have a medical kind of education, but they come from a service background, so they have learned what it means to serve a client or a customer well, and that's what they offer to the patient. So they have a 24/7 room service, for example.
Yes. No, and I love this idea. I think this is a great example because if anybody has gone to a hospital, you know that you're what's the word I'm looking for? You're somewhat treated like, like a government document, right? It's not always a good experience. But when you go to a nice resort or a nice hotel or whatever, they make a point of learning your name. And one of my favorite phrases when we stay at the Ritz-Carlton or any a luxury hotel is, you know, that'll be my pleasure, Mr. Martinez. And even though what do you call it? You are paying a good amount of money to stay at this resort. That makes the experience that much better. It's my pleasure to connect you. It's my pleasure to get you that. And so when you put that in a hospital environment, that I think is a great formula for success and referral business.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what they focus on here. And as I said, so it's like in a Ritz-Carlton. So when you check in, you're greeted by a hostess who takes you to your room, shows you everything around, so that you also feel comfortable because of, depending on the treatment that you're going to get, it might be something that it's also maybe a little bit scary, so they also want to comfort you in that sense. And on the other hand, they offer a lot of services for the doctor, so they make doctors' life easy. They offer space for their practices. They help them with organizing themselves in the practices with the other doctors. They help with infrastructures. They help with marketing. They help with strategy. All of these kind of services to the doctors so that they also want to be operating at Hills London. And these days, if you want to be a good doctor and you want to be a star doctor, a star surgeon, you need to go to Hills London. There is no other place. And clinics from around the world, like Mayo from the U.S., they have come to Switzerland to see how these guys do it.
Yeah, this is so interesting because, it's amazing, Mark, when you look at these companies. And again, ladies and gentlemen, the book is called The Art of Opportunity, and you can find it at theartofopportunity.net. You can also find it on Amazon. But what's important here is that we see companies all the time that break away from tradition. We talked about Amazon. We're talking about this hospital now. And they take a model and they change it by just a little bit, but that little bit is so significant that it revolutionizes that business.
Yes, exactly. And I think the main thing is it's a different perspective on strategy, on looking at your business. So instead of really going for long-term plans and all these things and all the you know, the traditional market analyses and trying to position yourself as either being low cost or whatever, they don't really care about these things. It's really looking at the customer and trying to find the opportunity there and then thinking about how can we really seize that opportunity in a way that creates value for the customer, but also for us, and in some cases, like with the hospital, also for the larger ecosystem, so all the doctors that are involved and all the partners that you need to be able to operate your business in a successful way.
Yes, yes. You know what? And another company that just came to mind is Tesla. I think Tesla is a good example. A couple of different things. You know, Tesla set the standard that we're going to create this kind of car. It's going to really work well. It's going to be a good car or a great car. And then one of the things that they discovered along the way is that the batteries for these electric cars were pretty weak. They didn't serve the public well. So what did they do? They created a battery, and all of a sudden their business, one of their areas of revenue has been the battery side. And they're actually creating batteries for their competitors like Toyota and GMC and Ford. And it just goes to show you, how the art of opportunity is just hidden there within all these companies.
Yeah, so again, it's looking at a new opportunity, let's say. So Tesla could easily have said, we want to protect our competitive advantage, so to say, and we want to hold on to our technology and our batteries. But I think in the 21st century, ecosystems become also more and more important. So you look at your environment differently, and in some cases you sell to your competitors, in other cases you partner with your competitors, and it's no longer the traditional protect strategies that companies apply.
And I tell you what's interesting here, too. Here's the other lesson. Because GM, Ford, and a couple of these other major car manufacturers, they're the ones who blocked Tesla from in a lot of different ways. They were opposed to the Tesla. They've gotten Tesla in court several times. They've shut down Tesla dealerships. And Tesla could have said, hey, these guys are the ones that are making me work a lot harder. I'm not going to sell them my batteries. But again, like you said, it's the environment has changed, and you could have, you could have that whole competitive spirit, slash and burn type of thinking, but that's not going to serve Tesla. And ultimately, Tesla, I think, was smart enough. They were humble enough to say, you know what? If all of a sudden these people become our allies, maybe we can do something with them down the road, and it's going to be nice to have our batteries in all these cars anyway, so let's just do it. Let's put our ego on the side and focus on the opportunity.
Yep, mm-hmm. Exactly.
I love it. Mark, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about the art of opportunity. Mark Snookus, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing today.
Thank you, Bud. Thanks.
Good stuff there. Good stuff there from Mark Snookus, strategic innovation expert and the author of the best-selling book, The Art of Opportunity. And I think that he gave us some great examples, things to be aware of. You might have some opportunities hidden within your business or your industry that you can now take advantage of. You may want to check out the book and see what it's there for you. You can go to theartofopportunity.net. And most of all, remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.